Hey, this is Joseph Wooten, and I am on Funktastic Chats with Mike Zabrin. We've been talking about everything today. We've talked about music. We've talked about culture. We've talked about history. We've talked about rhythm and respect. And there's lots to get from this conversation. So one more time. This is Joseph Wooten, a.k.a. the Hands of Soul, a.k.a. the keyboard player for the Steve Miller Band, a.k.a. Victor Wooten's brother.
Welcome to Funktastic Chats. Today we are talking with Joseph Wooten. This is the first of an exclusive two-part series. If you dig today's episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and be sure to subscribe. We've got a great show coming up. Joseph Wooten is a three-time Grammy-nominated artist, songwriter, keyboardist, and vocalist. Since 1993, Joseph has been an integral member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, the Steve Miller Band.
That's
he
right.
is a producer, speaker, and fronts his own band, Joseph Wooten and the Hands of Soul. Joseph also serves as the keyboardist to his brother, Victor Wooten. And on top of all of that, he's an author of It All Matters, from which there's a TED Talk delivered in Memphis, Tennessee, called Why It All Matters. So we're talking to Joseph Wooten. Hey, Joseph.
How you doing, man?
You live in Nashville, right?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes,
I'm in Chicago, so not too far from you.
I love Chicago. The Steve Miller Band loves Chicago. Every time that we come to town, or every time that we come to that region of the country, we stay in Chicago. And then we travel out from there because the band loves the city so much.
You know what's funny is I was listening to your original music way before I even knew that you played for the Steve Miller Band.
Yeah.
And I saw you, and it was in a suburb of Chicago. I think it was at Ravinia.
Yes, you know, it was 2007, probably.
Yeah, right. And I was like, is that Joseph Wooten up there? What the heck?
We filmed the video there.
Oh, really?
We filmed the video there, Steve Miller Band live from Ravinia, 2007.
Wow, I didn't know that. I've got to check that out.
When you saw us, Norton Buffalo was probably still with us, right?
Yeah, I think so.
On the harmonica. Yeah, that was 2007. That was when I was still doing the rap on Fly Like an Eagle.
I know. I got into your music years ago when I was first learning bass. And it's funny, when I was a freshman in music school, I just think this is a funny story I have to get out of the way. I sent you a message like out of nowhere more than a decade ago asking for you to check out a song that I was writing. And you wrote me back, and it wasn't like, oh God, who is this kid reaching out to me on his first song he wrote? What the heck is this on Facebook, right? Like, you wrote me back like this really detailed producer style notes with multiple messages, and at the end of it you wrote, "Don't overthink it, I love the track, it sounds great." And like, even today I'm like, man, to write this random kid a thoughtful message back at the beginning of his musical journey is something really, really cool. So I just wanted to thank you for that, because,
well, you know what, so I'm going to add a story to that story. And the first thing is that, like, that's the kind of stuff that's really heartwarming to me. Like, some people live for people to say, man, that solo that you just took was killing. And like, when we were kids, my mom, not just when we were kids, I mean, because there were five brothers and everybody was pretty talented. And people would say to my mom, aren't you so proud? You know, your five sons are so talented. My mom would go, anybody that's done something their whole life ought to be good at it by now, right? But she would say, if you tell me that they inspired you, or if you tell me that they helped you, or if you tell me that you look up to them in some kind of way, that's what makes me proud, because that's what I worked on. So for you to give me that story, that's the really kind of heartwarming story, because that's what music is for. Music is to make lives better. It's not just to make people go, wow, how did he do that lick? Wow, how did he, it's more than just a wow factor. I mean, music is the way that we help people to see life as it should be. Or I take that back. It's the way that we get people to feel life as it should be.
Yeah.
Because that's what music is. I mean, music is, we do it with tones, but it's a template for life in that it takes things that are different, takes things that are really different, and gives them a path forward that's good for everybody. And even if you don't like it, it doesn't hurt anybody, right? But it's a template. It's a template for how life should be, and it's why we like it. We recognize it right away. It's the more different the sounds, the better, right? Diversity works for music. Rhythm gives things that are different a path forward, makes them respect it, their space. There's a template if we just follow it from music. And that's why music tames the savage beast. Music brings out the best in us.
Tell me about that quote from your mom. It's like, the world has enough great musicians. What the world really needs is great people.
Yeah, my mom would say that that the world has enough good musicians. She would start it off saying often, what does the world need with just another good musician? We have enough of them. What we need are more good people. And that's what she worked on. She didn't discourage our playing because she could recognize, and both my parents could recognize that music gave us direction. But she knew that it was more important than what we were able to play was the musician behind the music, the person behind the music. So she knew the music business would be tough and it may or may not work out, but she knew that we would survive it, not just music, but life, by the quality of person that we were. So yeah. Both my parents worked on our quality of character and knowing that we would work on the music.
I want to talk about your debut album in 2003. It's called Hands of Soul, right?
Hands
that was
of
your
soul.
Debut album. Were these songs written over a longer period of time before the album came out? And the reason I ask is because all of these songs are so personal about your life. And I was just wondering, like, was this just like a collection of songs over time as your career kept going?
Kind of. I mean, some of them were new. I'm having trouble remembering all of them, but some of them were songs I'd had for a while, like Light in the Distance. I see a light in the distance. It's calling out my name. Don't care about my fame, but my heart. I wrote that back in the four-track days, right? Four-track recording, the four-track cassette recorder. You might be a little bit young to remember that, but back in the 80s, somebody came out with a cassette recorder that you could record four tracks on. It utilized the stereo on both sides of the cassette tape, and you could record four tracks. And boy, that just opened up my whole producer brain, because I knew that, like, I could put layers on and I could track vocal harmonies. Of course, you know how much hiss is on a cassette tape anyway.
Right, right.
So by the time you start bouncing tracks, I'm like, Roy, man, Reggie, Victor, Rudy, you got to hear this song. You press the play. You know what I mean? But I was able to put all these ideas. Victor had an analog delay for his bass. So I could run my voice through his analog delay, and it sort of had effects. And man, in fact, I just re-recorded a song that I wrote back in the 80s. Really not a really good ballad called Reunion, but it was those four-track days. I mean, there's a song on the Wooten Brothers record that we did with Kashif called, I think it wound up being called Waiting For You. Hmm. But it was a four-track recorded tune that Victor did, you know, programming the precursor to the Roland 808 drum machine. It was called the Dramatics. We used to call it the Drumatics, but it was spelled like Drum Addicts, Dramatics. We were adults before we realized it wasn't the Drumatics. And the funny thing is, I heard a rap song that that did a rhyme and used drumatics to make it rhyme. So I guess we weren't the only ones.
Wow. See, yeah. me being a 90s baby, like the cassette, the four-track cassette recorder is such a crazy concept to me, you know? And isn't that how you like auditioned for the Steve Miller Band or something? Like you sent them a cassette tape?
Okay. So yes, but by the time I auditioned for the Steve Miller Band, I had a program called Master Tracks. So it was a computer programming by then. I had upgraded. So, but I, hold on, I didn't answer your first question. The first question is, it was a collection of personal songs and songs that I had had for a while. Like Checking My Microphone was a new personal song. When No One Noticed Me was a new personal song. But like Light in the Distance was a song that I had from the four-track recorder days. Actually, the song We Want to Be Free, I wrote that song with Steve Miller in mind. You know, because time keeps on slipping. Right?
Yeah.
This is a story about a man. I figured, you know, that groove would be compatible. He didn't use it, so I was like, well, shoot, I'm going to record this. And so the answer to that question is, it was songs that I'd had for a while and new songs that I had done just for that. Obviously, Heidi's Waltz. Heidi was my wife at the time. I was my first marriage. So that obviously was a new personal song. It's one of my favorite, of all the things that I've written, it's one of my favorite pieces of you know, that it's one of my favorite pieces of writing that I've done for me in terms of chord structure. Now, your next question was...
I think I was just bringing up the cassette recording back in the day.
The four-track cassette recorder, man, that before, the only thing you could do was hit play, right? And it would give you a stereo recording of whatever the microphone on the cassette recorder. But the four-track cassette recorder had a playhead that had a record head that lets you utilize the stereo left and right on one side of the tape, simultaneously the left and right on the other side of the tape. Four tracks, right? So four-track recording, man, we were off and running. And like, you know, you just sort of, you're so excited about all the tracks you could do, you just forgot about how much hiss was on it. But yeah, so, you're asking about Steve Miller. By that time, I had graduated from the four-track recorder to a program called Master Tracks. And Master Tracks was computer programming. So I was doing a recording session. The other vocalist on the session was named Tabitha Fair. And the producer that had us in the studio was named Chris McCarty. And Chris McCarty was a co-writer of Swingtown, right? A greatest hit. So I'm doing the recording session and he says, you know, Steve Miller is looking for a keyboard player. He just lost a keyboard player. And you'd be perfect for the job. And he told me about the gig and, you know, you don't stay out all year. You can make all your money and, you know, during the summer and do whatever you want for the rest of it. And you know how it is as a musician, you hear like these sort of pie in the sky stories all the time. And you're like, I'm being polite. You know what I mean? I'm not going to blow him off. And we had a session the next day also. He said, hey, man, you should have sent that recorder, you know, you should have sent that audition tape yesterday. And he gave me Steve's mailing address. So I was like, okay, now I have Steve's mailing address. It wouldn't be smart. You know what I mean? That'd be really negligent not to send something in. So I sent in, I did a funky version a funkier version of Abracadabra. Normally, Abracadabra is right. I did, it's like. Right, I did I did that, right? I put a piano solo on, an organ solo, and a lead synth solo so he could like hear me play three different styles. And then I had done, at the time I had moved to Nashville and wasn't getting enough work. Like most people who moved to Nashville. And, I was surviving doing a lot of sound alike work. So a sound alike project is just what you think it is. You record to sound like the artist. So wherever they use it doesn't have to pay the licensing to the actual artist, right? So, I was getting most of the, for this particular sound alike person, I was getting most of the R&B vocal work. So I had just done Boyz II Men's a cappella version of It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday. And I knew part of the gig was singing harmony. So I was like, if he hears me do this, he's going to know I can sing harmony because it's all me, four-part harmony, right?
Yeah.
And then my brothers and I signed to Arista Records in about 83. Same time they signed Whitney Houston, same record label, same producer. Whitney signed a great deal. We signed a terrible deal. But, you know, her career went this way. Our career went that way. But my brother Roy played drums on her debut single, You Give Good Love. That's him playing live hi-hats over the drum machine. That's him doing live drum fills and cymbal crashes. That's Roy. When Whitney sang You Give Good Love, nobody was in the studio except me, the producer, and Whitney. I watched Whitney sing it. But when the producer, Kashif, was also producing a song that was supposed to be her second single called Thinking About You, she's in the booth singing, and she's in the booth singing, and I'm in there with the producer just harmonizing. He said, oh, man, I like that. Go in there and sing it. So I had some on Whitney's debut record, There I Am, singing with Whitney. So I was like, I'm going to send that to him because he'll know that I've done it at the top level.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I got the gig.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think the creative spin you took on Abracadabra had something to do with it? Do you think a lot of guys just sent them the, you know, the whatever was the straight part was, you
know? Yeah. I mean, he absolutely liked my feel. Like I've heard him tell the story since. He said he put it on and he listened to just like, you know, 60 seconds. And he was like, he got really excited and got ready because like, let me calm down, put back on and listen to the rest of it. And then he called me. So I think as a musician, you go by feel, right?
Yeah.
And I think he felt that I was the right kind of musician because he said he was getting all kinds of stuff. People were sending in things and it just wasn't, you know, it just wasn't what he was looking for.
Yeah.
So I think in hindsight, I think because I was coming at it in a more fresh fashion, right? Like if I were more steeped in the industry, I may have tried to do some more industry stuff, right? But I was just like, I'm going to show them how I play, right? So I took a piano solo, I took a lead solo, I took an organ solo, and you know, I tried to play tasty, and I tried to blaze. I just tried to play like me. And that was me singing harmony. That was me singing with Whitney. And then, I mean, there was nothing really for me to lose because I was already struggling.
Yeah. Yeah. I love how open you are about that, too. Two of my favorite songs in the Hands of Soul record is When No One Noticed Me.
Yes.
And checking my Microphone.
Yeah.
Man, like those two songs.
I was really pleased with Checking My Microphone, too. because it just sort of captures the life of a gigging musician, you know. Where is it? Another city, another stage, another story, another page. You know, it just sort of, I got a wife and children, still at home, a beautiful family, but I'm still alone.
Yeah.
Et cetera.
I remember being this kid being like, I want to feel those things. I want to tour. I want to feel that.
Well, you know, when you write music, you write music with an anticipation of how you hope people will receive it.
Yeah.
And I hoped that people would receive, you know, people would receive sort of the expression of the life of a traveling musician, you know, making my money and spending it fast, you know.
Right, right. That's the line. Yeah. I only play at the places that build character, right? Or is that when no one, I can't remember. I think that's it, when no one knows.
That's when no one knows.
Yeah.
I play my music in places that only build character.
Yeah.
A little or for no money at all. Yeah.
Uncertainty of both of those songs, the uncertainty of the future, being a traveling musician,
right?
Like, both of those songs have stayed with me for years as my music career grew, because the meaning just got so much deeper as I got older doing those things. And I guess my question is, even after you reach this, what most people consider an extraordinary level of success, can you still relate to the subjects of those songs 20 years later in some form or another?
Absolutely I can. And that's the way that I see it. And the older I get, it becomes clearer to me. So when you're young, you're looking for success, right? And success means record sales, big audiences, paychecks, notoriety. And then as you get older, you find out success is closer to the ground than that. And that's what, especially my mom, my dad too, but especially my mom, she would say, like, in recognizing that we were good people, she would say, you're successful already. Other people just don't know it yet. Right? Because truthfully, success is how connected you are and how comfortable you are being who you are. Right? If that's comfortable, then you're successful. Your life is meaningful. But if that's not the case, once you get rich, if you're not settled in who you are, then you have a million reasons to not be happy. Mm. Right? That's why we see rich people, financially rich, who are some of the most unhappy. Because When you're walking on the ground, it's important to have balance, right? Like, you might fall down. It's important to know how to stand up. But the higher you rise, the more important balance is, right? If you fall from 10 feet up, it's a different experience than if you fall on the ground.
Yeah.
20 feet up, 30 feet up. It's the same thing with success, right? If you don't have that balance, the more success you have, the more destructive it becomes. Right. If you, let's say you have a little bit of a drug problem, right? If you don't have money, there you go. Right. How many drugs can you do? You don't have money. Right.
Right.
But if you have all the money that you need, now that little thing is a big thing. Right. Or say you have a problem with fidelity. Right. Now, all of a sudden, there's women coming at you. Right. If you don't have that under control, especially, you know, if you have a mate, right? It's important that, so this, as I get older, success is my balance. And as far as I'm concerned, the things that resonate with other people is truth. Right now, in the old days, when you were trying to get into the music business, in the old days, the industry controlled the number of artists. There was only so many artists that could go in record bins in stores, right? That's one of the reasons why when things moved to CDs, they sort of had that BS piece of plastic on the CD just to keep the bin space comparable, right? The CD was smaller, which could have meant more bin space. But they weren't about to make room for more artists. So you put that piece of useless plastic on there just to keep the bin space comparable. Back in those days, you had to appeal to the industry and hopefully the industry would unlock the door and let you in, right?
Yeah.
Well, nowadays, the radio waves and the record stores have given way to the internet. And the upside of it is you're not locked out anymore. The downside is you're not locked out anymore, right? The street is crowded. The street is crowded with artists. And the only way for an artist to stand out in the crowd is to make connections. And truth makes connections. If I play something and you feel it, nobody can get it out of there. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm trying to play things that people feel, that resonate. And to me, the truth will always resonate. So, yeah, if I'm singing about the loneliness of being on the road, everybody's felt loneliness before. They just get my brand of it. That's a universal theme. If I'm talking about freedom, everybody understands freedom. You're talking about love. Everybody understands love. And you're trying to appeal to the part of people that everybody can relate to. You're trying to be real.
Yeah, that's a great point. Let's go back to when you and your brothers were kids. When Reggie was 10 years old, he started teaching you keyboard. I think what, you were five? Were you 5 years old and Victor was two?
That's the truth. That's the absolute truth.
So he was teaching you keyboard and Victor bass lessons, and a lot of other famous musicians have learned from Reggie at some point.
Yes, yes.
Could you tell our audience, who is Reggie Wooten and what is it about Reggie's teaching that really gravitated you and Victor to learning music?
Man, there's a whole TED Talk in that answer right there. But so Reggie's real name is Elijah Reginald. And so we call him Reggie. When we lived in, my dad fought in the Korean War in the Army. After surviving the Korean War, he switched to the Air Force. To my mom's chagrin, she was hoping he was going to get out and he switched. And fortunately, she didn't leave him. But we were born on Air Force bases all around the country. And I was born in Columbus, Ohio. Victor was born in Mountain Home, Idaho. Not long after Victor was born, maybe a year and a half later, maybe two, we moved to Hawaii. Now, in Hawaii, at 5 years old, you know, I wasn't quite going to school yet or starting kindergarten. And Victor, of course, wasn't in school yet. Well, in Hawaii, the school-issued instruments were the ukulele, the recorder. And so Rudy, who wound up being the sax player, picked up the recorder right away. He was good. I never remember him sounding like he was learning. Whatever he heard, he could play it. Roy was beating on everything. I never remember him sounding like he was learning. Whatever, he was good right away. And Reggie took Roy's ukulele. He could play whatever he heard, right? And somehow, one day, Reggie just, he says he's sitting outside and he just got the idea that we could have a band, you know? Music seemed fun, and it was something that we could always have a good time doing together. So he comes to 5-year-old me and 2-year-old Victor, says, you know, if you learn to do this and you learn to do that, we can have a band. So my brothers were always people to look up to. If we can be part of what they're doing, yeah, of course we'll do it. So one thing that makes Reggie a really good teacher is he does a good job of recognizing where you are and what kind of musician you are and what kind of person you are. So he'll say, like, with guitar players, he said, you know, he can look at him and, you know, as soon as they pick up the guitar, he can see some people, they're chord people. Mm-hmm. They want to learn chords. Other ones want to, they're lead players. They want to learn lead. Others want to play rhythm. And wherever they are, he starts them from there. So with me, I'm sure he recognized that I liked grooves. So he said, Joe, man, just, this all you got to do. This all you got to do. He said, just do that right there. That's it. That's all you got to do. So, you know, and then he picked up the ukulele and went. And I'm hitting this note and I can hear, like, I can hear the note changing, but not changing. Yeah. And like right away, I'm getting this tutorial in like the basics of, like, I can hear that this is, right? I can hear like that relationship is different and I like it. And it's Wilson Pickett. Like day one, I'm playing, I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour.
Yeah.
Right out of the box. So that is Reggie's special sauce, is in recognizing right away where a student is, starting them where they are, doing something that they can do, and then showing them why it's cool. Because after that, heck, I want more after that, right?
Yeah.
So he was like, you know, you're doing that? Just do these notes. Right? And that felt good, and he just keeps you leading you a little bit farther down the path. And when it feels good, then you're self-motivated to go do more. And of course, the whole time is like, one of these days, man, you're going to be the best in the world. You're going to be the best in the world, man. I'm telling you. Same thing. He did the same thing with Victor, because Victor wanted to play like this. And he was like, Vic, play like this. You're going to be able to play twice as much stuff. I'm telling you, one of these days, you're going to be the best in the world. You're crying right now, but you're not even going to remember when you were crying. You're not even, and Victor says he doesn't remember it. But that was, that's how he taught us. We loved James Brown. So before he taught us notes, you know, what key is it in? You got to know what key it's in. So this right here, that's the James Brown key, right? We called it the James Brown key. What key is it in, Reggie? It's two down from the James Brown key, right? Long before we learned what C was.
Right.
You knew where it was before you knew what to call it. Eventually, he taught us what to call it. Eventually, he taught us quarter notes, eighth notes, 16th notes, where it is on the staff, and all of that stuff. I mean, most of the music theory I know, most of it is from Reggie. And, you know, I could teach it. I could absolutely teach a theory class. You know what I mean? From stuff that I learned from Reggie. I mean, when Reggie was in high school, he wrote, not just wrote the high school's alma mater, but he arranged it for the marching band, for the orchestra. So there's horn parts, string parts, lyrics by a high school student.
Wow. Yeah. As you got older, and actually this goes into your book, It All Matters, What I Believe, Words That I Live By. Mm-hmm. I love this quote from your book, and I kind of want to see if we can kind of relate it to musical concepts as you got older and started learning more theory, whether it's from Reggie or from other bands. Concepts are useful tools, but meant to be put down eventually, like a canoe that saves your life carrying you to the shore. You love the canoe for saving you, but if you don't let go of it after you get out of the water, it becomes a burden and a hindrance. Right, right.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, in regards to music, it's learning musical concepts that necessarily aren't transferable over to the gig result in how a musician learns to become self-taught and innovative.
Well, anything, any concept is a tool, right? And a tool serves its purpose, But once the tool serves its purpose, it's meant to be put down, right? You can build a house with a hammer, saw, nails. But if you're walking around carrying a hammer, saw, nails, it's a hindrance after a while, once the house is built. See what I'm saying? So with music, you practice your scales so that you can stop thinking about scales and just play with them. That's why we play music, right? You learn to walk, right? Left foot, right hand, right foot, left hand, right? Until you don't have to think about it anymore, so you can just have fun moving around. We get so, it's easy to get caught on concepts. And once you get caught on concepts, it's like carrying around that canoe, right? The canoe has served its purpose. So you can put it down now. Once you know what a 2-5-1 is, you can mess with it. It doesn't have to be that way all the time. Like I was talking to a person the other day. There's a song by DeBarge.
And it
does a different, but it does a different take on the 2-5-1. Like normally it would be, all this love's been waiting for you, right? He moves this note one here. He moves it to here. All this love's waiting for you. Now, this is not really the rule, but you know the rule. There's no reason that you have to stick to it, right?
Yeah.
Right, he moves it there. Same thing with Stevie. Stevie, normally a 2-5-1, it's a minor 2 to the 5 to the 1, right? And Stevie, this is the only place you'll hear it. Stevie does a major 7-2. Da 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 dee da 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 dee da da da, right? Da 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 da. Don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, mama. Da 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 da. Major 2, major, like major 7-2. That's against every rule in the book. Dee dee. Da da dee da da da. Right.
Yeah.
The rules are there to learn so that you can not just break them, just so you can put them down. They're guideposts for going forward. Right.
When you teach, I know you teach music and with middle school students and high school students when you're not on the road. How do life experiences play into speaking to these kids? I mean, whether it's like listening to, you know, great music with just what you demonstrated with the 2-5s or or other types of life experiences, how are you able to really find something that really resonates with students that you speak to?
One thing that I learned from my parents and from watching the way Reggie teaches people, you can feel the audience and have a sense of what it is that they need, right? If it's a music class, there's lots to teach about making music that applies to life, right? So like I talked about the beauty of music is it takes things that are different and gives them a path forward. So like if I would say to a music class, I would say, we know that music is rhythm, harmony, and melody, right? In my opinion, of the three, rhythm is the most important because it gives you a path forward, right? So harmony tells you how to feel, right? Happy, sad, right? And, you know, right, that makes you feel a certain way. Melody gives it an identifier. It's like the license plate on the car, right? It's the address. If I go da 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 da, you know what symphony I'm talking about, right? Even if you can't name it. But rhythm is the thing. If I go, rhythm gives me a chance to go, right? Rhythm gives those chords a purpose. Okay, so what rhythm does like, I make music, right? But this is what I make music from. What I make music from is a mess, right? But it's a mess with potential. It's a mess with potential. And what we do with notes in music is what we should do with ideas in life. And I'll tell you what I'm talking about. What rhythm does is rhythm and the spaces between the notes gives you a chance to turn the mess into some order. It gives you a chance to turn it into some order that's good for the benefit of all of us. So when we talk about music, all music is we're hearing the beauty of taking from the mess and giving it order and a path forward. That's why we like it, because we recognize that music is life as it should be. Diversity, right? Yeah. Diversity, the more, you know, like, nobody wants to hear their favorite sound played on nothing but trombones, right?
Yeah.
Or played on one instrument. The more instruments, the better. Now, the problem is that when we step away from the instrument or we take the headphones off from listening to music, we cease trying to find a path forward for things that are different. Because in life, music, life is a jam session of ideas. Essentially, it's a jam session of ideas. But the difference is in life too often, diversity is trying to invalidate the other one. When you hear people arguing, they're trying to invalidate the other one. They're not trying to find a path forward. So I think the most important thing you can learn from music is that in music, rhythm makes things that are normally not compatible, it gives them a relationship. Like, take the two most random things. A lot of times I'll drop a chair and I'll cough. Two things got nothing to do with each other, right? But if I put them on the beat, drop, cough, drop, cough, drop, cough, drop, cough, drop, drop, cough, drop, cough. Now, these two things, because of rhythm, have a path forward. Now, why do they have a path forward? One of the reasons is because rhythm makes them respect each other's space, right? So off of the instrument, if you replace rhythm with respect, it'll do the same thing, right?
Wow. Yeah.
If the other person knows that you respect them, there's a potential path forward. The same way, if I put something on the beat, that doesn't mean that every time I'm going to write a great song. It just means if the music is going to be good, it's going to have to involve some rhythm.
Yeah.
In the same way that if differing opinions are going to have a conversation, they're going to have to respect each other. Music gives us a blueprint. It gives us a blueprint of how to go forward successfully. So I had a person that said to me, like, I recognize that on paper, but like, how do you do that in real time for somebody? And, you know, we picked the most say you're talking about what's the most divisive issue, abortion or elections or whatever. I told them, often what I'll do is before I make my point, I'll make their point so they know that they're heard, because that's a basic necessity in life, is to know that you're heard. So hypothetically, let's say we're talking about the election, right? Mm-hmm. And you voted for Donald Trump and I didn't, hypothetically. And I'll go, like, I'm not saying you're unreasonable for that. You thought the last leader was weak. You thought this one was strong. You thought the last leader wasn't financially smart. And you thought Donald Trump was. You thought the country needed to be run like a business. So you picked a businessman. You knew that he wasn't Gandhi or Jesus Christ. You know what I mean? You knew he had some warts, but you were willing to roll the dice. I understand that. But here's my concerns. Now, it's more likely that person's going to listen. It's not a guarantee, but it's more likely, because I'm looking for a path forward for the way that person thinks and the way that I think. And if that person voted for whomever they voted for, or, you know, feels whatever they do about abortion, or they're religious or they're not, or whatever it is, if they know that I respect them, we have a path forward, right? If, because most of life is outside of who you voted for, right? So if that person, a lot of times I'll, before we finish, I'll go, hopefully if you see me and my car is broken down on the side of the road, you're not going to drive by and leave me there in the rain because we didn't vote for the same person.
Right.
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 And that's,
well, maybe not you, you're Joseph Wooten, but no, I'm just kidding.
I mean, but no, you'd be surprised how far that goes. Because what works in our favor, like what music does, music shows us what's in the space. You know what I mean? And life is more space than it is stuff, right? There's more space. If you blew up an atom to where you could like see the components, they say that the nucleus would be about the size of a grape, and the protons and the electrons would be like running the bases, right, on a baseball diamond. That's how much space there is. I heard another guy, I love talking about the concept of zero in space. Anyway, that's another conversation. But he said a physicist told him that if you took the actual amount of stuff, physical stuff, that was in the Brooklyn Bridge, the amount of actual protons, neutrons, electrons would be about the size of a paperclip. Be the same weight, but about the size of a paperclip, which basically lets you know most of life is space. Yeah. And what we're doing with music, we're showing you what's in the space. Space has rules, right? Rhythm proves it, right? If I'm doing this, right, I gotta put some notes down so I can share with you what I'm doing. But the music pre-exists me putting notes in. And it's like in my TED talk, I said that notes are like the beautiful confetti thrown into the wind of music, right? You wanna see what the wind is doing, you throw confetti up and then you can see the beautiful patterns of the wind. But if you study in confetti, you're not wrong, you're just missing most of the point.
I love when you played the first five notes of the piano and you were like, you see this? This is actually the national anthem?
Yeah, all the notes of the national anthem.
But this,
yeah, I think that's what it is. It's like, do you know what that is? No. I said, those are all the notes of the national anthem. And like, your hand's not over your heart. Why?
When you were talking about, you know, earlier with you dropped a chair, and then what else did you say? You dropped
cough.
What?
You drop a chair and you cough.
Drop a chair and you cough, you know, and it creates a rhythm. And oftentimes with that rhythm comes repetitiveness. And sometimes it's the most simple message that comes across. Like, for instance, like if I take your song, We Are All in This Together. Do you remember that one?
Yes.
Like that phrase, is the last 2 minutes is you singing that phrase over and over again.
And
every time you say that, it's even more emotional experience for me as those 2 minutes go by. Mm-hmm. Does it start with lyrical content for you most of the time, or does it start with keyboard?
It's like everything. It's things that are meaningful come to you different ways, right? Sometimes, like that one started from the lyric. I think I was watching the debates, and this is when there were like, you know, 145 Republican candidates. I'm exaggerating. The election before last, right? Remember when the election that Trump won, remember how many Republicans there were before? And I was looking, there was like so much divisiveness, and it just made me think, you know, if people just realize that we're all in this together. So of course I start thinking about music that would help bring people together. And that's where that song came from. Ironically, and this was not on purpose, I was recording that song, and the day that I was to go sing the lead vocal was the day after we found out that Donald Trump was going to be our new president.
Wow.
That Holy day cow. Was the day that I went in and sang the lyrics, you know, we are all in this together. And And what I recognized was that it was a theme that people received, because for not quite the first week, there were about 10,000 views a day, right? There were about 10,000 views a day. So I know it was a confirmation for me that people want that positivity. They want it. Yeah. Because that's what we're made from. Like, we didn't create ourselves, right? So what makes me hopeful is that I know togetherness feels good. I know being respected feels good. I know being heard feels good. So if we're talking about something divisive, that's normally divisive, I try to put it on a bed of me hearing what the other person has to say, me letting that other person know that if we both love the country, we're not enemies, and letting that person know that I don't think they're unreasonable. And you can go a long way with that. There's no guarantee it's going to work every time, but it's like playing music. If you're going to write a good song, it's going to have to involve some rhythm. Rhythm's not a guarantee of a good song, but it's got to be the start. It's got to be an integral part, I should say.
From your recent TED Talk, your book, your albums, I mean, it's so apparent that you're using music as a tool, right? To make the world a better place. And I know you read a lot about history. What types of things have you been thinking about lately or reading about lately?
Okay, so that's a good question. I just wrote on my Facebook page the other night that if you don't know your history, there's a good chance you have misconceptions about our present, right? And what I'm always trying to do is find a way to bring people together. That's my thing. And I know right now the country, we're having a reckoning with race and culture. And the question that's been on my mind recently, like I heard them ask Tim Scott, and I heard them ask President Biden, like, is this country racist? And I've heard people take a beating for the answer yes, and take a beating for the answer no. And I know what my answer is, and I've been working on, and I'm going to do a live stream on it. I'm the other thing I'm working on now is a podcast.
You need to start one. Oh my God. You need to start one. I'm happy I caught you before you started one.
No, that's all good. I will be available even after I start one. But the answer to that question, the question is too simple, right? The question is too simple. Is the country racist? I heard Bill Maher said it's not like a yes, no answer that you get from like a pregnancy test, right? If it turns blue, we're racist. You know, it's not like that. Let me take a step back and I'm working on being more brief, but the country, we're patriotic, right? Patriotism is a big part of being American. Why? Because of the actions of Americans, you know, 1776, right? Well, we got to remember, by the time 1776 rolled around, we had had slavery for 147 years. See what I'm saying? So the country was racist long before it was patriotic. And when it was patriotic, that patriotism was funded with its slavery, right? So our patriotism and our racism are interlocked. We're working our way out of it because slavery is no longer here, but the shadow of it still is, right? Because after slavery was gone, what followed? Another century of Jim Crow, another century of state-sponsored. The Brown versus the Board of Education came in 1954. The South refused. South, like, we're not integrating. I don't care what you say. We're not doing it. The South came with the Southern Manifesto, which basically said the Bill of Rights, you've overstepped your bounds, right? You've overstepped. Yeah. It's unconstitutional. You've overstepped states' rights. So that was their response. So certainly we were still racist then in Prince Edward County, Virginia, from 1959 to 1964. They're like, if we have to integrate, nobody's going to public school. They just shut public school down, took public funds and routed them to private schooling where black people weren't allowed, so white kids could go to private school for free. And like then, like now, what's targeted for the people at the bottom winds up affecting everybody, because white kids, a lot of the kids that used to go to public school didn't go to private school. So it hurt white kids' levels of getting a diploma too, right? It decimated black kids because they literally couldn't go to school. And like my mom, you know, when she was going to school, she's in elementary school, all 12 grades in one room, one teacher, right? Just forcing you to have an inferior education. So that stuff, the shadow of that still carries over now. The main one, the aftermath of forcing integration, and what happens to this day, why schools are still segregated, we're as segregated as we've ever been school-wise, is that zoning. So from 1942 to 1968, black people weren't allowed to live in the suburbs. It was against the law. That was the Federal Housing Administration. So what does that mean? Black people are forced into overcrowded housing tenements, homeless, or back on the farm. Like in Chicago, when we complain about black on black crime, that's why they're there, because for generations, over a quarter of a century, they're forced to be there. I mean, for the whole history of the country until 68, they're forced to be there. So what winds up happening is in the suburbs, property value is up, right? Well, schools are funded from property value, right? They're funded from property tax. So if you live in an affluent neighborhood, you got a well-funded school. If you live where there's overcrowded housing, there's probably strip bars and liquor stores and gun shops, and you probably live close to the dump, waste, your property value is down. You have an underfunded school. Well, it has a racial outcome. The language is racially neutral, right? But if the affluent neighborhoods get the affluent schools and the largely poor, largely people of color schools are underfunded just because of their zip code, that question of is the country still racist becomes a bit more murky, because the teachers in that underfunded school, no teachers teach to get rich, right? The teachers, most of them aren't racist. They're teaching because they believe in what they're doing, right? So it's not a simple answer of, yes, this country still racist. The teachers, these teachers, a lot of them are they're almost social workers. Especially by the end of the year, they know these students, poor and rich. Affluent teachers are great people because you don't make enough money teaching, and yet they still put their heart in it. So it's not an either or question. We still have some of the racism that's still carried over and plays out in the way that we do things. We see it in policing both ways. We see great police. We see awful police. We're still dealing with the racial issue, but it's not an either or. And the either or answer will get you in trouble if you can't speak with some nuance, which is why it's important to learn history. It's why it's important for a musician that has a tool as powerful as music to make people feel even the controversial without, like I have, there's a song that I wrote for Jacob Blake, who got shot, you know, 7 times in the back, right? The man with bullets in his back, it didn't ought to, I'm sorry, the man with bullets in his back, it didn't ought to happen. It's not his fault it happened, you know. How can it be more so that a man with ammunition in the back of his torso can be seen as the criminal? It must be something dark and subliminal, where from behind you pull the trigger, and the man with bullets in his spine is seen as the... you know, you can sing things and make people feel them in a way that you can't talk them and make people feel them without an argument. And that's, in my opinion, it's why it's important for a musician to be well-informed and well-intentioned. It's not that you got to be such an incredible musician. You just have to have a feel for what people, how people are going to receive the thing that you're trying to give to them.
Do you think we as musicians have a moral responsibility to not only be educated ourselves and where all of this music from Motown, soul, and funk music that we love, but also, like, think about it. Almost at every wedding, you hear "My Girl," you hear mm-hmm. "The Temptations." Do you think that if people learned about the music that they love, the history of the music they love, there would be less division in our country? Because,
well, I think a moral obligation. I don't know a moral obligation. I think it's good when musicians do, because we have a tool that almost nobody else has, in that we can say things in a way that once it's in there, nobody can take it out. Like a good example, President Biden did his first speech in front of both houses of Congress. And, you know, the speech, depending on what side you're on, was either good or it wasn't. But after the speech is over, there's somebody, Tim Scott, comes in and says exactly the opposite, and it muddies the water. Well, if I play a song and you receive it, there's nothing anybody can do that'll get that song out of there, right? Musicians have that tool that politicians don't have it. Yeah. Authors don't have it. Athletes, they sort of have it as long as that your team won. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those 84 Bears, you know, I'm sure the 84 Patriots don't feel the same about the Super Bowl shuffle, right?
Right.
But I hope I got the year right.
But I think so,
But my point is, music is such a powerful tool for change. We Shall Overcome. They sung their way through the endurance it took to come out of, you know, the Jim Crow South. Negro spirituals did the same thing. They sung their way through the human atrocity of slavery. Music is perseverance. It's teaching. It's soothing. It's endurance. It's all those things that we need, because music, we recognize that music is life as it's supposed to be, and it's accessible, right? We can feel life as it's supposed to be by singing, by listening to it, but certainly by creating it. And does a musician have a moral obligation? I don't think it's a moral obligation. I mean, if you're allowed to write a song just because people enjoy doing the twist. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's okay too. But I won't say a musician has an obligation, but a musician that decides to do the right thing with it wields a powerful tool. I think it was Victor that said, we know about destructive bombs, right? Bombs that and everything's destroyed. Victor said, I think the closest thing that we have to a peace bomb is music. It's the closest thing we got.
That's so powerful, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorists, people in just like hateful groups, they're cutting off the hands of musicians, right? I mean, it's just such a powerful tool. I mean, the Beatles, what, they were on the FBI's most watch list because...
Listen, John Lennon, they revoked his visa. They kicked him out of the country because he's interfering with the war effort. Right. They're trying to get people to feel patriotic and enlist. And here's a guy with the guitar, not the greatest singer in the world. He's just a guy with a guitar and a voice. They got people singing Give Peace a Chance, and they're having trouble getting people to enlist. You know, this guy armed with a guitar and a microphone can't be in the country anymore. Right. That's how powerful music is. The president, you know, the president could have held a press conference anytime he wants, but he's not as powerful as the the able musician that can reach people. Roy is the one, AKA Future Man. Roy is the one that said, he said, everybody remembers Beethoven, Brahms, Schubert, Mendelssohn, all those people, Franz Liszt. Nobody remembers who the king was then.
Yeah, nobody.
Nobody remembers the king or the politicians around. Nobody remembers them because music is enduring like that. And there's, it's okay to just make people dance because that takes people away too. Now, that takes your mind off of things too. And that's, that is some people's forte. Not everybody's a politician or a mover of culture. Music takes our mind off of our problems if it's done well. And there's a place for that. I'll never say that you have an obligation. Da, 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 da. You know what I mean? You don't have an obligation. I would say you have an obligation not to try to hurt anybody with it. You know what I mean? You know, to be peaceful with it, to try to make things better with it. But
Joseph Wooten, thank you so much for hanging out with me, man. It's been a blast. And I know you're podcasting, but what else are you working on? Are things starting to come back for you?
Yes. Yeah. Last week, I had a bona fide busy week. I mean, I was in the studio on Tuesday, then I was in the studio all day on Wednesday, and then I had to cram a bunch of tunes on Thursday for a rehearsal on Friday. Then I had to drive to Birmingham to play the wedding on Saturday. Then I had to drive back and play a jazz brunch on Sunday. It felt good. It felt like I was back to it. So I'm recording some new music. I'm doing a lot of reading, preparing for the podcast, recording for some other people. My wife wants me to write a children's book. So I'm kicking around some ideas for a children's book, trying to do some more helpful things with. We have a charity, imatteryoumatter.com. I mean, I Matter, You Matter Incorporated. You can go to imatteryoumatter.com, spell the Y-O-U, Y-O-U Matter. And it's there to honor diversity, to help young people, to help homeless veterans, especially homeless veterans, because I always say the word veteran and the word homeless should never be in the same sentence. So again, just trying to find a way to use my music, my voice, my ideas, my interactions in a way that makes the world better and shows other people how they can do it too. Because the best teacher that you have is example.
Would you be down to play something for us before we go?
Sure, sure. Let's see. We don't have to be perfect. But we've got to do better, because we are all in this together. We are all in this together. We're in this together. Appreciate you.
Joseph Wooten. You can go to www.josephwooten.com and get both of his albums, his latest book, and look out for his podcast. And Joseph, I appreciate you coming on, man. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Mike. I really appreciate it, man. It's been fun. We got to do it again. When I get my podcast, I got to get you on.
Yes, sir. That'd be amazing. We had a whole other conversation after we stopped recording, and the stories that Joseph was telling were so interesting that I had to just tell him, like, yo, we have to hit the record button again and do part two, because our audience needs to hear this. I'm going to give you a little preview about what's coming up next week. Check this out.
We were in nightclubs when we were in elementary school. Like, Victor was in, we opened for War when Victor was literally 5 years old. He was five, I was eight. We opened for Curtis Mayfield 2 years later. Victor was seven, I was 10. We were children, but our parents were there. So when we'd see other people get drunk And we were like, we'll never do that because we're playing music. We don't want anything to compromise our music. So, and my mom was making sure that we turned out to be the right kind of people. So we didn't have those. We had the desire to be the right kind of people and good musicians because our parents made sure that we did, and not all young musicians have that opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in to Funktastic Chats. If you want to learn more about Joseph Wooten and you can't wait till next week, go to www.josephwooten.com. You can get a copy of Joseph Wooten and the Hands of Soul's latest album called Soul of Freedom. Some of these songs we were talking about earlier in the podcast that Joseph was demonstrating. And check out the discography page because he is on some incredible albums. He's playing on Kashif's records, Whitney Houston's record, Victor Wooten's records. Let me know what you think of this episode by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or head over to www.funktasticchats.com. We'll see you next week with Joseph Wooten Part 2.